Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we finally break down Disney's crazy new slate. We review Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and director Paul Greengrass joins the show to talk news of the world.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 147 of Real Blend, a podcast that would trade producer Gabe for a PlayStation 5 right about now. On this week's show, we finally get to catch up with Disney's crazy new slate announcement. Naturally, all of that news broke the minute that we posted our latest episode. So we're going to circle back around and talk about all the fun things that Disney revealed is coming. We are going to review Chadwick Boseman's final performance in the Netflix film Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And Paul Greengrass joins the show to discuss his new film with Tom Hanks, called News of the World. My name is Sean O'Connell. I am the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and I am joined, as always, by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jake. How are you?
Hello, my friend. I've decided that our podcast is the podcast equivalent of Good Luck Chuck. You remember that Dane Cook movie back in the day where he would sleep with a woman and it would then like that, then that woman would then turn around and like instantly get married. So women would want to sleep with him because it would mean that they would go on to find their true love.
Oh, I gotcha.
If we record an episode,
yeah,
it means tomorrow there will be breaking news. It means 5 minutes after we're done recording, there will be breaking. We are the podcast equivalent of Good Luck Chuck.
It's also literally like people who listen to the show on a regular basis are poking fun at us on the Facebook page that's driven. Yeah. They were like, of course this news breaks right
after. And we don't always record on the same day. So you can make the argument, well, why don't you guys record? We've recorded Mondays and then there's news on Tuesday. We've recorded Thursday and there's news on Friday. It doesn't matter when we record.
Doesn't matter at all. The other person joining the show, as always, Kevin McCarthy, Fox 5. Hi, Kev.
Sean,
in Washington, D.C. Fox 5, Washington, D.C. Sorry, I cut you off.
Thank you. No, Sean, Gabe, Jake, good to see you.
Good to see you. That other voice that you might occasionally hear punching in throughout the show is producer Gabe. Hi, Gabe.
Wait, who's that?
Well, new people who are joining the show late don't know who Gabe is, which is kind of like on brand. Like, I like the fact
he's like he's like the neighbor in Home Improvement. Just kind of on the other side of the fence. We can really only see a little bit of his face.
Wrapping us up. He's silently wrapping us up. Housekeeping. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Nice to see you. A lot of people tuned into our Patty Jenkins interview for Wonder Woman 1984. Hopefully you guys have hit the subscribe button and you are going to tune back in on a weekly basis to the YouTube page. If you're listening to us where you get your audio podcast needs served, there is more information in the description or the show notes of how you can sign up for our YouTube channel. We are really close to 1,000 YouTube subscribers, and you know me with my OCD. This is something that bothers me a lot. I would like to get to 1,000 or cross over it, maybe by the end of the year. How about that? I'm going to throw that out as a goal. 1,000 subscribers on YouTube, on the YouTube channel, by the end of the
year. Where are we at right now?
880-something. So that's feasible. Come on, that's doable. Jake, throw some of your thousands upon thousands of YouTube subscribers over to us. Post something on the Instagram.
Just like Instagram. A story. It's cleaner.
Can't you do a story?
Dude, I'm trying to get to 100,000 on YouTube so I can get my little silver button. That's my goal. Yeah. That's my very specific goal.
You know who we should have back on the show? Chris Van Vliet. He would put us over the top.
God, no joke. That dude's got it.
Is there a wrestling tie-in coming up somewhere that we can
either
pull
need
in?
To know wrestling or have six-pack abs?
This is really odd, too.
I know either.
Looking at the this is really inside baseball, but there's a traffic story on Cinema Blend right now that is blowing up. It's going through the roof. It's about Jake Paul calling out some UFC fighter, and the UFC fighter shared our story on their Twitter account.
And this may be an ignorant question. How is that a Cinema Blend story?
It's just
more
because
the blend part.
Yeah, less cinema, more blend. Well, we had a TV section, and those fights get aired on television, so we cover sports a lot. Yeah, I know. Anyway.
We had a TV section, and it is on TV sometimes.
It's.
But we do pop culture stories. It's pop culture related.
Entertaining to see Jake Paul get pummeled by... Actually, he's a pretty good fighter. He's been doing pretty well. All right, listen. Anyway, we're off the rails. Weekly poll. We did a weekly poll, and usually it's themed after relevant stories, but sometimes we like to just detour into randomness. And so we asked last week, do you mix your chocolate snacks and your popcorn? Mainly because I think that that's really horrifying when people do that. Oh, Gabe, what's the matter? You seem surprised.
Continue. Sorry. I didn't mean to react so honestly.
Kev, I'll give you the three options.
Okay.
Do you mix chocolate snacks and your popcorn? The options were every time, sometimes, and gross, never.
Gross and never is a bad answer.
Why?
Because, like, I don't do it, but I don't think it's gross.
Well, then you would say sometimes.
No, because I don't do it.
Oh, you're too picky.
Gross and never are two completely different answers.
Do you know the weekly poll
would,
is...
But you would go to that answer if you only had the three. You would just go with never. But
it's, the weekly poll is something that any of the hosts can do week after week.
Yeah.
and really...
I forgot the Twitter password.
If you have an issue... So anyway, Kev, which one do you think won?
Well, I mean, one of the things I find interesting about that poll is, like, I do mix them, but not the way you would think I do. So, for example, if I get a large popcorn, I'll also get a Goobers, which is a candy with, like, chocolate and peanuts. My dad and I used to get them when I was a kid, so I kind of, like, continue getting them. So what I'll do is I'll purposely shove a whole thing of popcorn in my mouth and then shove the Goobers in my mouth and chew them at the same time.
Okay. But that's the correct way to do it.
Right, but I don't pour the chocolate on top of it because I don't want it to all fall to the bottom. But I do like the two together. So I don't know where I would fall in this poll if I do it independently of each other. So would I be a yes? Independently is fine.
Sure, independently is fine. I think I did necessarily mean putting the chocolate into the popcorn, but
that's
you in your mouth...
It.
But in
if they're both going to your mouth at the same time, what's the difference?
So there's a big difference, and is the consistency. So it's the same. So I was thinking about this the other day. Think about when you get a plate, right? And let's say the plate has steak, asparagus, mashed potatoes, sure. Which is like a meal that Jake and I love a lot. If you put all that in a blender and spun it all up and drank it or ate it that way, it would be a different taste or consistency. Than it would, I don't know. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I feel like that's different. I feel like what we're talking about is if I get a piece of steak on my fork, a little bit of mashed potatoes, and then put it in my mouth together versus getting a piece of steak in my mouth and then a little bit of mashed potatoes and chewing at the same time.
So you're saying what you would do with the steak and mashed potatoes is what I'm doing with the popcorn and chocolate.
No, I cut a little piece of steak and then I get a little bit of mashed potatoes on it and then put it in my mouth.
Right, so it's just the idea, the problem
we
is...
We wanted this show to be short, and it is not going to be short today.
In all honesty, this is a very interesting conundrum.
I love this poll.
I love when you say conundrum.
Well, when you're in a theater, it's not possible to see where your chocolate popcorn ratio is in the dark.
Sure.
So that's why I do it independently.
But it has nothing to do with... texture or taste or anything.
I like that Kevin knew that the chocolate will fall to the bottom of the bag because that's a man speaking from experience.
Dude,
like,
So to go back to your question after my long explanation, I would argue that our audience, give me the three one more time. Sometimes, always,
every time,
and gross,
every time,
never.
Sometimes, and gross, never.
I'm gonna say our audience went more with sometimes.
They actually went with gross, never, 57%.
But see, I don't think it's 57% people saying gross.
Yeah.
I think it's a large number of people just saying that they don't do it.
No, they
did.
That's
why it's a flawed poll, man.
They said gross, never.
By the way, can we explain how underrated Goobers are? I feel like they're like a kind of the lost candy in the movie theater candy aspect of things. Like Milk Duds kind of fall into that category.
What's
too,
in the middle of a Goober?
Goober is the raisin one?
No,
it's a peanut?
It's
oh, Raisinets
peanut,
are the raisin one.
Raisinets. And then, like, I feel like the go-to candies everyone says, like, you know, again, I love Sour Patch Kids, you know, Skittles. I just feel like Goobers doesn't get the respect it deserves.
What are the ones that are chocolate-coated but, like, super chewy?
Milk Duds.
Are they Milk Duds?
Milk Duds are my jam.
I love that we chose this poll to like do something less serious, and we've had a more intense debate over this poll than any poll we've done.
Yeah.
Like a poll over the changing of the industry of which we love so much.
Yeah.
Solid 45 seconds.
So here,
chocolate and popcorn, 4 minutes.
So here's the new thing that Lauren and I do, and this is actually born out of a movie theater. And so Regal started doing Cheetos popcorn, like Cheetos flavored popcorn.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, all right.
And so what Lauren and I will do is we'll make a popcorn, like a microwave popcorn, whatever, and then we'll take jalapeno Cheetos. And then just pour them on top, but shake them into the popcorn so that every pickup has a couple of Cheetos in it. That would be similar to the chocolate thing.
Are you tall and thin? That makes no sense to me.
Because I've seen Tenet 6 times, and I can't stop. Like my mind is always racing, so I have a high metabolism. By the way, we're recording on Tenet Day. By the way, today's Tenet Day.
Or Heat Day, depending on how you think of it.
National Tenet Day. Everybody can see Tenet now. Oh, and this is a very important PSA, and I know, and then we're going to move on. I've checked the digital version of Tenet. Anybody out there who's watching Tenet, watch it on a hard disk. Please get the hard disk, the Blu-ray or the 4K. I got a Blu-ray, and I put the digital code into Vudu. The Vudu does not have the aspect ratio IMAX shifts. So if you want to see Tenet the way Nolan shot it, you might have to just get the hard disk. I know people out there are like, I don't buy discs anymore. But if you want to watch the film the way it's intended, Damien Chazelle told us he's trying to watch Dunkirk on iTunes and it didn't have the ratio shift. So if you're seeing Tenet for the first time, do it at a hard disk if you can.
Kev, we have established over the years that you and my son, Brendan, are very similar. So I need to ask you something about your eating habits before we move on from the poll. Brendan doesn't like his food to touch. Are you a person who doesn't like your food to touch?
It depends. I mean, but you're talking to somebody who hates tomatoes, cucumbers, celery, onions, Brussels sprouts, zucchini, squash.
Right.
I hate all that stuff. So if any of those things touch my food items in a salad or on my plate, it ruins it. A tomato on a burger, removed, burger's done. Ruined.
Okay. Because it's like specifically he uses multiple utensils because he wouldn't want to eat like mac and cheese with a spoon and use that same spoon to eat another piece of food.
I would say it's a little extreme, but I will also agree with you that I think Brendan and I are very similar in the sense that we like the certain things. So I wouldn't judge him on that. I just feel like you have your own way of doing it. I don't do that. But but Brendan, you know, more power to you, brother.
I think it's extreme and we cater to it. And that's a problem.
So you're doing multiple dishes. Like washing.
Oh, so many dishes. We run the dishwasher once a day.
I appreciate that he has conviction, about that stuff at that age. You know what? You might as well. If you feel a certain way, Jake's in my same boat. Jake and I are very picky eaters, and you have to be confident in your pickiness.
I just gotta say, I've never understood other people's fascination with how other people eat or what they eat. Like, especially like honestly, and you guys, I love Chicago, but the whole like no ketchup on your hot dog or your pizza has to be of this thick. Like, who cares?
Oh, I love
who cares what other people
dog.
Eat? Eat what you want to eat. I don't have to eat it. You eat it.
Right. I mean, you're wrong about Whataburger, but other than that, I agree with you.
Speaking of Whataburger, Paul Greengrass joined the show this week. I had no way to transition. This is one of those we're recording it before it actually happened, but we have Paul Greengrass on the calendar to discuss his fantastic new film, News of the World, starring Tom Hanks. And so a hashtag if it happened. Without further ado, we hope, the Real Blend podcast interview with Paul Greengrass on behalf of News of the World. Hi, Paul. It's Sean O'Connell from Cinema Blend and the Real Blend podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Very nice to see you.
Nice to see you also. I love this film. I am so moved by it and blown away by it and just so impressed by everything you accomplished. Whenever I watch a Western, an authentic period Western like this, the ones that have the ability to really transfer an audience back to another time, I can't help but think to myself, this shoot had to be loaded with all sorts of headaches just to bring them to reality. Can you tell me a few things that are really difficult about pulling off a Western that you probably didn't think about until you were in it?
Well, we had the whole lot on this film, a child actor, horses, cattle, dust, extreme heat, extreme cold.
Right.
Very challenging locations that we had to be roped up to 2 hours at a time, roped on because of safety. Rattlesnakes, a lot of rattlesnakes.
No way. I would have left.
Yeah. Spiders, biting spiders, you know, wagon crashes. We had everything. And safety issues, of course, but, you know, doing a horse chase and a wagon chase. Here's the thing. The easiest thing, if you'd asked, if I'd given you that list and you'd have said to me, what are you thinking at the outset if it was going to be the most difficult? I would have said that the most difficult is to find the young girl to play Johanna. I thought that was going to take months. I thought we were going to have to see hundreds of young girls. It turned out to be the easiest decision of the entire film because Gail Mutrick's one of the, literally about a week after we'd started looking, Gail Mutrick, who's one of the producers, phoned me up and said, oh, have you seen System Crasher yet, which had just won Berlin? I said, no, I'd love to see it. She said, oh, I've got a copy. I'll send it to you. I watched it that night. Have you seen that movie?
I have not, no.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. It won the Berlin last year. She's amazing in it.
Okay.
And I looked and I thought, well, it obviously has to be her because how many 11-year-old girls that good are there in Germany? I know it had to be a German actress, you know.
Right.
And she came over a few days later and we auditioned and I gave her the part there and then. So it turned out to be the absolute easiest decision. The rest of them, the horses, the cattle, the rattlesnakes, they were, you know, the climbing up to locations 2 hours every morning, every evening on ropes, that we just had to do. But, you know, it's interesting. When you make a film that's extremely arduous and physically demanding, as that one was, weirdly, we all got into it. It became like a whole adventure. You know, and we were sort of all bound together. And I think everybody really loved making that movie because it was an adventure. And I think that shows in the film, incidentally.
Well, it helps that you and your leading men are just voracious students of history. And if you don't get the period details correct, you're both going to be disappointed in yourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious about working with Tom again a second time, something that you learned about him on the Captain Phillips collaboration that you thought you were able to really capitalize on in this film.
Well, I didn't know he could ride a horse so well. I don't think he knew he could ride a horse so well. I didn't know he could handle, you know, period firearms as well as he did.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing when you work with people a second time. You know, you know, we'd obviously got to know each other well, but this is a very different film. He'd never made a Western. I'd never made a Western. And, you know, it was a challenging physical ordeal for him. And he was amazing. I mean, he just, whatever you threw at him, he was game for it. And it's hard, you know, being in the saddle, getting off and on the horse, galloping, you know, racing around, you know, the rocks and the height, and you know, it's big stuff. And he was fantastic. And then, of course, beyond that, there's the Tom Hanks, the fantastic actor, the brilliant movie star, the decency, the brilliant instincts, the hard work, the thoughtfulness, the intelligence. And I think that, well, honestly and truly, I think it's easy to take Tom Hanks for granted a little bit because his standards are so high. The movie, you know, his performances are always so good.
Right.
And he seems to have been turning them in now for year after year for many decades. And he has been, you know. But, you know, you're talking about one of the greatest actors, one of the greatest movie stars of all time. He's
right
up there with Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda.
Right.
You know, he's a great, great explorer of the best of what it is to be the best of us, you know, to try and surmount your doubts, your fears, your difficulties, and still remain decent. And I honestly think this is one of his greatest performances. I do, because it's really about this lonely newsreader who wanders from small community to small community with his satchel of newspapers, reading in old barns at night or in dusty town squares. It's the healing power of storytelling. He's weaving a tiny thread in a broken world in the shadow of the Civil War, trying to draw people together through the healing power of storytelling. And then he meets this little girl in the woods, and reluctantly he sees that he's the only one who can take her home.
Right, right.
Thinks it's her home. And the journey becomes the journey towards healing, the journey towards a better place for both of them. And they both have to face up to, you know, the grief of the past to move forward to a better place. And that's why I made the film, because I'm a parent and our world is very difficult, I think. Whatever, I'm not making a political point here, whatever our politics are, I think we'd all agree the world feels, you know, divided, too bitter, you know, stuck. You know what I mean? We can't move forward, lacking in unity. What's the road forward here? What's the road to healing?
Well, compassion. Compassion, yeah. I think. I think that's what the movie radiates, compassion.
Exactly. And Tom Hanks does that. He shows you that it's not going to be leaders that are going to fix this thing. It's going to be ordinary people who are going to find their way out of this division and bitterness. And that's what Kid and this little girl and what their journey is all about. And I love that at this time, Christmas, you know, this movie that's about the journey towards hope is going to come out. I think it's wonderful that Universal are going to put it out in theaters, albeit for all the difficulties, because we need the healing power of stories right now.
Right. You
know, we are the storytelling animal. We tell stories to our children. We tell stories to our parents. We tell stories in the home, in the bars, in the cafes, in the street corners, in our cinemas, in our theaters. It's the collective healing power of storytelling. It's what expresses our humanity. And right now, because of COVID, our ability to tell our stories to each other, whether in the home or in a cinema, is very, very limited. And we all feel it. And also it's limited because storytelling itself is under attack.
Right.
As is in the film, you know, because people want us to substitute lies for truth and truth for lies. And he faces that in the film, and he has to face it down. And it's part of his journey to get to the final scene, which is it's a redemption story. But at that moment, he is at one with his audience and with the little girl. Everyone is healed, if you can put it that way. You know?
Absolutely.
And I love that about the film.
I want to get to Darius's work and cinematography, and I would like to get to your editing approach, but I want to just backtrack just a second for something you brought up about taking Tom Hanks for granted. Is that what, in your opinion, did that cost him a nomination for Captain Phillips? Because to me, that was one of the most singular.
I thought so. I thought he was utterly brilliant in that film. Incredible power, incredible... you know, incredible humanity. And I didn't think he got the recognition that he deserved. And, you know, hopefully people will see this, you know, because I think this is amongst his very finest work. I really believe it.
Absolutely. We debate the biggest, not that, you know, Oscars matter, but the biggest snubs to me from your work would be Tom's performance in Captain Phillips. Yeah. And then something I didn't realize until just recently, United 93 not getting a Best Picture nomination, when to me it's probably the greatest film released that decade. that decade. And I'm glad you got in the director conversation, but it astounds me that it didn't make it into Best Picture.
Well, never mind. These look, you don't make films for awards. They're nice if they come and you know, it's Tom, that it's your actors and the people that you've worked with. I mean, you know, I know you want to talk about Darius, you know, when you make a film, here's the thing. It's the central experience you have as the filmmaker, as the director, is that you are the jack of all trades, but the master of none, surrounded by the masters of their craft. So when you're standing 10 feet from Tom Hanks in a scene, you know, the hairs go up on the back of your neck. You know, it's, I can't tell you what it's like. I'll tell you what it's like. It's like standing right next to one of the great violinists of the world, or, you know, a master painter, you know, a true artist. You're looking at an artist in supreme command of their craft, and you've right. got the privilege of being right up close and personal to it. And it's the same when you look at your cinematographer. You know, Darren Wolski is one of the great cinematographers. I mean, he's shot so many big movies, you know, a lot of Ridley's great movies,
right.
but other movies too. And I wanted to work with Darius, but I've wanted to work for a long time, but I thought this would be great for us both because I'd never shot a Western and I wanted to make a film that felt different, but still authentic to me. It had to feel like one of mine, but feel different. You know, you make films, you've got to break new ground. You've got to challenge yourself. And I wanted to do that with this. And I thought that Darius would help me. Well, first of all, we got on like a house on fire. But he did. He had that sense of scale and grandeur, and we would push and pull each other to do things so that it ended up with this intimacy and intensity that I like, and a feeling that you're really there. But it also had a classical movie identity that I loved as well.
Well, one element too that I found different was your editing approach. And obviously the work that you did on the Bourne franchise kind of plunged people into the action sequences. You have one of the most suspenseful, elongated sequences as a shootout on a cliffside. And I thought you took such a different approach from what you normally do. Could you just talk about how your editing informed your storytelling this time around?
Well, I wanted, as I say, to slow the tempo down a little bit. You can't always make the same film. You have to challenge yourself. That's
sure.
That's the key to staying in the game. And but you know, I'm very lucky to have Billy Goldenberg editing with me, and he's a maestro. And you know, he knew that I wanted this film to feel a bit different. Still be me, still feel authentic to me. And, you know, he knows that I love to craft action sequences that start as one thing, move to another, then to another, then to another. You know, so you get this elongation and the fact that you live in it. But I didn't want it to feel fast cut and frenetic. You know, I wanted it to have a deliberate build, a classical build, but still have you held on the seat, you know, on the edge of your chair. And I thought Billy achieved that whilst also nailing all those intimate characterful moments, you know, and also this, because action, there's no point to an action sequence unless it has a profound truth about character that lies behind it that you find through action. And in that sequence, what you find at the end of it is that these two characters, the old, you know, the lonely newsreader and the young girl, have learnt to trust each other through going through the experience of that chase and shootout. And that makes the action sequence earn its place. You know, you feel like you've got to the next stage in their journey as characters.
I was fascinated by the concept that news for the people at that time was treated almost as a distraction from their day-to-day.
Yes.
And almost had an entertainment aspect to it, a performance almost of the news reader himself. Mm-hmm. I think news nowadays is quite the opposite of that. It's so we're so immersed in it that it isn't a distraction. It is our day to day. So what is your? I would love to know your opinions on contemporary journalism, modern journalism, and how they might have informed how you approached the way the storyteller operated.
Well. Look, I think that there are lots of colors to kids' news reading. You know, first of all, as a wandering news reader, he's rooted in his community. They're his people. He understands those communities. You know, the roots of these traveling news readers would have been the traveling preachers, you know.
Right, right.
You know, the roots of Methodism were the traveling preachers who traveled in you know, what was then England. And then, of course, when they came to the, you know, to the States, the same thing, you know, they were the people who brought the good news, you know, and with the good news came the news. And so you had this sort of, and of course, you know, a traveling preacher who could perform would draw a larger crowd. And, you know, but then you go on to the, you know, after the Civil War, it's a landscape full of dislocation, lost people, broken people.
Right.
And people are wondering, you know, he makes his choice. His kid has lost his printing press. He can't, as he says in the film, he can't print the news. He couldn't print the news. He'd lost everything. He couldn't print the news, but he could still read it. So that's what he did. But really, what he's actually doing is he's engaging in the healing power of storytelling. He knows that's what he does. When the very first scene, he says, "Good evening, Wichita Falls. You know, pleased to be with you again, you know. And I'm going to tell you some stories. And for an hour, we're going to hear about the great changes that are happening out there. And you can escape your lives for that hour." But the news is also challenging. Some of it's necessary news. You know, he starts with news of a meningitis epidemic. When we shot that scene last year, it didn't have the resonance that it has today.
Sure.
You know, later he talks about the federal news. That's deeply unpalatable to his audience. It challenges his audience. And he is, you know, abused for telling them those stories because they don't want to know about those changes.
Sure, sure.
But Kid responds because he understands their fears. He understands their anger. You know, he doesn't. He tries to persuade them. You know, he's trying to heal. He's trying to, without being preachy, he wants to tell the news and he wants people to hear him, you know.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. And that goes on, you know, all the way to the redemption story at the end, you know. But
well, I'm absolutely
things have colors of today, I think.
I'm absolutely going to pair this with Tom Hanks as Ben Bradley, legendary Ben Bradley in The Post. Because
well, exactly. Exactly. But yeah. The interesting thing is Tom is very, very, very interested in obviously the spoken word and the written word. You know, he collects typewriters and he's a great student. And I could feel when he put that black frock coat on, he was standing in a tradition that, you know, went from the traveling preachers through Mark Twain, you know, and onwards. And by the way, also informs the movies too. You know, this is a world, the world of News of the World is a world before television, before radio, before movies, before social media. But, you know, movies had their birth in hard lives. You know, people went to the great movie palaces because they were warm and bright and places that would transport them from hardship for an hour or two.
Right.
So there's something about this film now at Christmas. I'm very proud that Universal are putting it out in the cinemas. It's not a good time to put a film in the cinema, as we know. but we have to stay true to what we believe in. We believe movies will come back, and we can't just say that. We have to try it. This is Universal's, and I agree with them. We have to release it. Okay, it won't be the best time to release it, but it's a statement of faith. It's a statement of intent. It's a statement of belief that movies will come back, and they will, that in 6 months' time will be better. And there's no better film for these times, I think, than the story of the lonely newsreader with the healing power of storytelling, searching for a way out of division to a better place.
I totally agree. I'm so honored to speak with you, sir. I love the film.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
See you later. Bye. Bye.
Obviously, we want to thank Universal Pictures for giving us time with Paul Greengrass. News of the World is coming only to theaters starting on Christmas Day. And honestly, it's one of those shows, one of those movies, as you can tell from our conversation, that demands being seen on the big screen. The cinematography is absolutely phenomenal.
Sean, I would say that Paul Greengrass is an incredible, like his name is synonymous with incredible quality.
Yeah.
Not nearly as popular as he should be. But always consistent and never going to let you down. Much like the burgers of Whataburger.
See, then my transition made sense. There you go.
And that's why Nolan is in and out.
Yeah, pissing and a lot of people off lately.
All right, come on. We can't go down that road. We're going to get too lost in burger talk and our favorite filmmakers. And when we have plenty of stuff to get to.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Starting with the Disney announcements and the slew of content that's coming to Disney Plus, it was kind of one of those. It was unusual that somebody took a clip of a recent show of ours where I had said in conversation with you guys, hey, I think it's time for Disney to potentially do a DC Fandom type event where they just lay out everything that's going to be coming from all the properties that they own, be it Marvel, be it Star Wars, be it Pixar, the home entertainment section, the live action side. And that's essentially what they did. They turned the Disney investors call into their Hall H or D23 type panel and laid out everything that's going to be coming to theaters and coming to home entertainment. One of the big takeaways was that they're not going all in the way that Warner Brothers did in the controversial way of saying everything is HBO Max and limited theaters day and date. When Kevin Feige got to something like Black Widow, he still said, we're looking forward to bringing it to theaters. We'll see you in May. Movies like Shang-Chi and The Eternals are still going to be going there. Star Wars doesn't have anything on the docket immediately that would have to worry about going to theaters. But the announcement that Patty Jenkins was going to be doing the Rogue Squadron movie. Of course, she announces that the day after she comes on the Realm Planet podcast. That was the ultimate slap in the face of news breaking right after we do something really cool. Because she said today, or in a story that's making the rounds today, that she's really far into the template for what her story is. So clearly she's been on the docket doing this Rogue Squadron for a long time.
Can we give Patty credit for that brilliant video that she put out that she directed? Sure. Yeah. I just wanted to say, like, anybody out there who hasn't seen it, it's an incredible video. It's a very vulnerable video from the perspective of somebody who's sharing something very personal to her. And obviously you think about, I say vulnerable because you think about somebody putting their personal life out there, talking about her grandfather, right? Her grandfather was
her
grandfather,
her father.
Her father.
Yeah, I think her father. It was her father. And like you think about like how personal that is to her to put that out there and then to transition her passion into the world of a film of Star Wars that comes from, that's born out of the incredible patriotism of something like what her father did. So I just think it's a really, it was really cool to see her talk about it in that way. It just made me feel more personable towards her and towards the project. It actually made me care about the project more, that she was so like out there about her life and her family. So to me, that made it more immersive and emotional. So,
and her walking toward the X-Wing is just, I got chills.
It's insane. Like,
it's so cool. Yeah. So cool. I am now convinced, and if it doesn't happen, I'm going to be disappointed, that I want Chris Pine to follow her over and do Star Wars to become an X-Wing pilot, because...
Did you ask him about it?
No, because I was running out of time and I really wanted to talk to him about Spider-Verse. It was going really fast. I would have just asked if he... Yeah. But you know, if I asked Chris Pine, like, do you want to go to Star Wars? Well, I'd be honored if Patty would, you know, he'd give me that answer.
So he'd That's be in Star Wars and clickbait. Star Trek?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's done Marvel and DC, so why not?
Yeah.
Be fantastic.
You know who else is in Star Wars and Star Trek? Simon Pegg. But this he had to like hide himself this underneath the aesthetics, basically. Yeah. But I just think Chris Pine would be ideal as a because he does in my interview with him for Wonder Woman 1984, he basically admitted that he patterns all of his heroes after Harrison Ford, the reluctant sort of you know, vulnerable human type of hero anti-hero that Ford loves to play. He could bring that blast of charisma to the Star Wars universe. So I would love to see it happen. It seems so obvious that they probably won't end up doing it. But let's get back around to the announcements. Kev, of all the things that got revealed, whether it be Star Wars or any of the Marvel projects or Chris Evans doing a Buzz Lightyear movie or any of that stuff, what stood out to you from the Disney announcements that you're most chomping at the bit to see?
Weirdly enough, it's the Chris Evans Buzz Lightyear thing, and I'll tell you why. Because I think the concept of a movie about Buzz Lightyear as a human prior to the toy character that we got. And again, it's one of those situations where we're dipping back into the well, we're going back to something that we've already seen. I just found that to be that piece of news. I mean, all the Star Wars stuff obviously was a huge deal, but I for me. It just there's just so many Star Wars things that I don't even know what to be excited about. And like, you know, I don't know about you guys, but Star Wars is such an interesting thing. I know it's more personal to Jake, but, you know, after Rise of Skywalker and the discourse, I was just getting tired of Star Wars. And then Mandalorian pops out with one of the most insane seasons of television I've seen just from a production scale.
Are you caught up?
I have to finish the one we discussed last week, but the last Friday. So I've seen I saw Filoni's, I saw Rodriguez's. I think Filoni's episode The Jedi with Ahsoka is probably my favorite episode in the whole season so far. But anyways, so back to what we were saying, that's kind of why Star Wars isn't the route I'm going with this answer. It's more of like, there's just been so much. The Buzz Lightyear one just kind of fascinates me. I'm actually interested to know. I actually think that's a really cool concept. I'd love to know who that guy was prior to becoming Buzz Lightyear. So
for me, it made me rethink about Woody has a line in the first film where he's talking to Buzz, and he says something along the lines of, like, wait, do you think you're the real Buzz Lightyear?
Yeah.
And I never really thought about what that line meant. Mm-hmm. I thought he just meant, like you think you're the character that you were, you know. But now there's another layer to it, because it implies that there was a real Buzz Lightyear, and they made toys based on him. It would be like if you had, like, a, you know, a Buzz Aldrin toy that came to life.
Or an Evel Knievel, like a big time Evel Knievel.
I'm curious though how that works. So the Buzz Lightyear character that he's playing is the human being that he's
human,
playing.
Yeah, the human
his name
that exists.
Is Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, he exists in the Toy Story universe.
Okay,
that's my understanding.
Isn't how Pete Docter explained it on the actual video was. They always pictured Buzz Lightyear's toy to be based on a really cool movie, and this is that really cool movie.
Oh, so that's interesting.
So it's an actor
who plays Buzz Lightyear. Maybe that's him.
I think so. Yeah.
What the hell?
That's what I gathered. Is that they always explain this
to a 6-year-old?
Well, sorry. The simplistic way to explain it really is it's a movie about the person Buzz Lightyear is based on. And I think, but then you get into the weeds of, okay, is it a person who's playing Buzz Lightyear? Then that person.
You got four grown men right here who can't figure it out. So.
In all honesty, that to me was the most like what the hell kind of head scratch moment. I was like, that sounds kind of cool. Like I'm interested in seeing that. And plus, I'm all Pixar'd up right now, literally on because of Soul, and we have Pete Doctor coming on our show for Soul as well. So we're, you know, I think I'm just in a Pixar mood. I watched Wall-E yesterday again. Nice. I love that movie. So,
Jake, yeah. I'm going to defer to you for Star Wars. They have 10 projects coming. Things like Ahsoka Tano getting her spinoff show. The return of Hayden Christensen. What direction are you going in terms of? Well, first off, I'm going to ask you this question, kind of knowing the answer. Does it feel like too much at this point?
I'm going to say no, because I feel like if the movies have taught us anything over the last 5 years, it's that now that we're branching away from just that core Skywalker saga, not only are there way more other stories in this galaxy to be told, they also, like, you know, George Lucas based this on, like, serials that he watched growing up as a kid. So to me, it's only, like, poetic that we're going back to, which is why I even kind of give Mandalorian a pass for basically kind of being a mission of the week, because Mandalorian is the exact kind of show that inspired George Lucas in the first place. So maybe Star Wars is, granted, I will be super jacked every time a new movie comes out, but maybe Star Wars is a type of story that needs to be told in sort of a weekly basis over long forms with those weekly cliffhangers and stay tuned, reader, next week, this and this and this, or, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I am slowly kind of really digging this new mode in which we are getting Star Wars stories. Not just new Star Wars stories, but a new way to ingest them. And to me, the thing that really made me go, oh my God, is Christensen returning as Darth Vader. I mean, because if you think about, like, who that character was at that time, a newly christened Darth Vader, still almost still probably still scabby, still crispy Anakin underneath that suit,
is
probably vengeful and pissed and furious and heartbroken at Obi-Wan.
Right.
If that's the direction they take, because, you know, we never really got to see the emotion of Darth Vader once he became Darth Vader. Like, we got to see Anakin, and then he became Darth, and then he was sort of that very, you know, somber.
In Jedi, you get a little bit of, you get the emotion.
But at that point,
he's
almost, but by that point, he's kind of slipping back to Anakin by that. I think I would like to see, like, almost, like, furious, pissy, like, I want to kill, you know, I want to find Obi-Wan and kill him. Because there's not really, there's a line in A New Hope when he senses Obi-Wan on the Death Star, and he says something like, I haven't felt that since, ... and never completes that sentence. So we don't know when the last time is that they've seen each other. We all thought it was on the shore of Mustafar when he was burning. But what if they have seen each other since then?
Okay, I got a bunch of questions that I don't know if you know the answers to.
Yes.
A, if he's Darth Vader, why do you need Hayden Christensen? It can literally be anybody in the suit.
Well, he did play Darth at the end of Revenge of the Sith.
Okay.
And it also, perhaps...
Rise.
I think there's got to be a reason to. I love that
because
scene.
Because I've heard that they could potentially do flashbacks to show
flashbacks.
Like Clone Wars stuff, like Obi-Wan and Hayden Christensen before he converts. Second question: does this mean they have to get James Earl Jones to voice more dialogue? If Vader's going to be a character in this series, or are we going to get to the point where James Earl Jones can't voice Darth Vader anymore?
I think I would make the argument we've already gotten there.
Yeah.
I felt if, like, a few years ago, even with Rogue One.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, to no fault of his own.
No. Gosh,
he is an older gentleman.
Yeah.
He's not going to have the strength and the timber that he had 50 years ago. He's just not. I think we are probably at the point of finding someone who can do a really good Darth Vader impression.
He turns 90 in January. I was just thinking about this, like, because I one of my favorite movies he's ever been in was The Sandlot, and I always, like, he's old in that movie. That was, like, 93 or whatever it was. Like, he was old in that film. Like, the dude is turning 90. Yeah.
I pop onto Cameo every once in a while just to say, I'm always curious as to, like, what celebrities are on Cameo and how much they're charging. And I don't know, Sean, you probably didn't, but Kevin, did you ever watch Boy Meets World?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was a big, like, I love that show, and then I saw that, like, Mr. Feeny is on Cameo, and, like, and it had a picture of him from the show.
Oh, no.
And that's my perception of William Daniels, who I think was also, he's been on a bunch of other stuff, but to me it was Mr. Feeny. And it was, like, but then you see videos of him, obviously he has age, he is an older gentleman, as happens with life, and it's just sort of that thing where, like, yeah, that's right, because he was older when I saw this show 20 years ago. So naturally, yeah, he would be older then. It is, but it's a weird feeling, right? You almost kind of like have to check yourself.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, you have to be almost like ashamed to be really sad. Cameo makes me really sad. We've gone down the rabbit hole of Cameo. Once we were doing it for a birthday gift for a friend.
Yeah.
And the people that are on there, first off, it's like largely C and D level people.
Sure, sure.
And like I watched Debbie Gibson performing some of her songs like at a piano in her lobby.
Yeah.
In the lobby of her Las Vegas house. And it's just, it made my heart hurt of just being like, happy birthday. I hear you're a mom of two.
Like, did you guys see the Smokey Robinson one from this week?
No.
Smokey Robinson, who is on Cameo, was hired by someone to wish their mom a happy Hanukkah.
Okay.
And I guess whenever they sent it to him, they spelled it, because there are two spellings, one with H and then one with CH. And I guess Smokey Robinson, poor man, had never seen it spelled with a CH before.
Oh, no.
And he goes, your sons would like me to wish you a happy Chinookah. And he goes, I have no idea what Chinookah is. I think it's made up, but I'm going to go ahead and wish you a happy Chinookah.
Oh,
and
Smokey.
It was just like, yo, Smokey, man.
It's just so sad. Speaking of age and our aging heroes, I know we've had this conversation before, but during the Disney announcements, Indiana Jones 5 got confirmed. And Harrison, God bless him, there's conversation that this will be the last one. He is currently 78.
Sure.
And again, looks phenomenal for 78. I'm not saying anything against him, but by the time that rolls around, we're going to be seeing he'll be 79 at the time of filming, if it starts relatively soon. He could be 80 at the time of filming, if it really gets pushed back. Is this going to work? Kev, I'm going to ask you, is this going to work?
I mean, it's interesting, right? Because he did Force Awakens and he was great in it. I don't know. I mean, that was, what, 2016? I don't know. I mean, like,
80.
I don't know, 70, like late 70s. I mean, George Miller directed Mad Max in 69.
Saw him. He looked good.
Yeah, he looked great. I mean, I feel like there's, I don't know, I feel like that. I think there's one more left in him. I mean, I don't know. I hope, I want to see it again. We got to wash away that fourth one. I mean, we just have to.
I mean, I think that's why Ford wants to come back so badly and do one more to go out. I don't think, I think he, either he wishes he could take back Crystal Skull and end with them riding off into the sunset with Last Crusade, which, honestly, I wouldn't mind. Or I think he's really hoping he can bang out one more good one and have us sort of go, well, maybe four was not great, but we end great on five.
Yeah.
They're not going to do digital Sean Connery, are they? Like flashback?
No, because they address that he's dead. And
no, I know, but like flashback.
Oh, I don't
like,
think, I don't think so.
Do anything
I
like
think
that
would be, that would be terrible. A very bad taste. Yeah.
I have a quick question about Mandalorian for 2 seconds. Because we were talking about it a minute or two ago. Do you guys notice in every week of the show that it basically the basic premise is he has to do a favor for somebody to get to the next point?
It's a video game.
It's like, I feel like every week it's like, yeah, well, I'm here for this, but you need to help us with this first.
You have to, it's like a drinking game, actually. You take a shot every time they're like, we'll help you, Mando, but first.
Yeah. Yeah. My buddy Chase pointed out something to me, and it was like now I can't unsee it, which is how many different times the Mandalorian puts Baby Yoda in absolute peril just by like, just wait here, and like places him in a place, and just like, what do you do every week? He leaves him somewhere. Like, just hold on to that little child. Just hold on to him.
Yeah.
I do dig the Grogu name. I'm a fan of Grogu.
It's growing
like
on
it.
Me.
I love it.
I kind of
grew on it. Jammy.
Do you guys buy the? Maybe it's official. I only saw it in like memes. Do you buy the George Lucas tie-in?
I do. Yeah, I kind of do.
Oh.
The fact that
it's Gorgu, is it George Lucas?
I like that.
He was
like
there the day they shot that scene, apparently. Yep. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to a topic that is very close to my heart, specifically, and Kevin's because he's wearing the sweatshirt today. Zack Snyder is teasing that his Justice League is the 4-hour cut, is going to be first R-rated for language and for extensive violence, because he says Steppenwolf is just going to be chopping people in half, and that there's at least one moment that he knows of where Batman's going to be dropping an F-bomb. And that he is pushing, or at least collaborating with, he's collaborating with HBO Max, which is something that I've speculated on, which is now that they have a deal in place for stuff that's going to HBO Max, is also going to theaters. Why wouldn't the Justice League be going to theaters? And he is saying that he would like it to come to theaters as well too. And that he's been playing around with restoring aspect ratios. He's been talking about restoring aspect ratios to BVS. So that there's a rumor that he might do like a Man of Steel into BVS, into the Justice League, a theatrical marathon type thing. I think this is phenomenal. What I would like to see him do, if this is actually going to be the plan, is to wait until all four episodes are out. Give people the chance to see the story if they want to. I don't know if I wouldn't mind if the episodes as they dropped, since it's a four-part series, if the episodes also dropped in theaters at the time. I don't think theaters would say no to this opportunity. I think they would snatch up anything to lure people into the theaters. So, yeah, now that I'm saying it out loud, I guess my first chance to see the new episodes, if they give me the option to see it in a theater, I absolutely would go to see it in a theater. It seems like he's designing these to be seen in a theater. And to me right now, that sounds like the best news possible.
So all 4 hours will be black and white, right? And then they'll all have the bars on the left and right. So it'll be like a 1:3:3 or 4:3 ratio, essentially.
They're not black and white. He's released some material in black and white, but they're fully colored. No, everything
is fully colored. Wasn't the trailer black and white?
Mm-mm. When they released the initial trailer at DC Fandom, it was normal color. Then he released a black and white version when they had to take the music out of it because they got copyright dinged for Hallelujah. I think just because they couldn't use it for a very long period of time. And now they are back using it. So.
There's no way it's actually letterboxed or there's no way it's actually square, right?
I think it is.
No, I don't think they're going
to
let him do that.
I don't know. I really don't know.
It's the same thing we talk about with Make. We're like, if someone, it's not as drastic, but like if you decide to make a movie in black and white, you are making the decision to cut out a huge chunk of the audience who's just gonna dismiss it. And I think that if someone turns on their TV and it's square,
right?
I don't know. It's a superhero, so I guess maybe they're already sold.
But ironically, like the same way my parents, like if they ever accidentally rented a widescreen VHS, they're like, what are these bars on the top and bottom?
I don't see people at home with like their 60-inch TVs that are only like a third of them is being used.
Right.
Being
honestly,
really
I agree with that. And I get why it would be that way. I understand it, but that would really annoy me if I'm watching a square for 4 hours.
Have you guys
IMDb saying it's 1:3:3:1. That's the official ratio. That is a square box. And then anybody does say it's in color.
Have you ever hit
said IMDb said that? Oh. Yeah. But I think that's all based on that trailer.
Yeah. Have you ever hit the ratio button on your remote control by accident and it like warps your image to fit something different? Like, if you watch everything in standard or theatrical, am I the only one that's ever done this? I seem to do it all the time. I hit a button and it either stretches wide and everything looks so weird and so distorted that I can't rebound and come back.
I don't think I have like the button on my remote. I think I have to like go into the, I can't easily accidentally do it. I think I have to go into the menu to actually do it.
So I'm hearing March for this, and I don't
Isn't there something else with the Snyder Cut coming out in March as well?
Well, yeah, Jake, that's very funny that you mentioned that. My release of Snyder Cut book has been moved back from February 15th to March 1st, so I hope that the movie comes out March 11th. That would be ideal for the book to come out right before the movie releases. Yeah. How do you guys feel about the episodic nature of it? If they keep to episodes, would you want to go back once a week to the theaters to see them? Jake, you wouldn't even be able to.
No, I would want to watch them right in the old Hamilton cinemas.
All at once. How about a 4-hour cut? Kev, you down for a four-hour cut?
Closer. I'd watch a 4-hour cut in theaters.
Would you rather?
Yeah. I'd rather watch a 4-hour cut in theaters than go back 4 times in theaters.
If it's 4 hours, can we get an intermission?
I'm assuming that they would. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
He'll make a Snyder cut right in the middle. Yeah.
How long was The Irishman?
7 hours and 37 minutes.
3.5. No, it was 3.5, wasn't it?
I was along for the ride, but I also wouldn't have minded an intermission.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the long story short is that it's if it's good, no one will care, right? If you're invested.
Sure.
I would have minded some better CG on their faces too.
Yeah. Kev, I know you're psyched about the R rating. You have to be psyched about the R rating.
Oh, no question. Dude, the BVS R rated cut is unbelievable. I was rewatching it this weekend, and just like the blood squirting out, like, and like, just like the, there was the warehouse scene. And like, I remember interviewing Snyder for BVS and actually talking to him about what the R-rated cut was going to entail. And then, and what he said in that interview was exactly what it ended up being when they released that cut. I'll never forget. Like, that warehouse scene in R-rated is amazing. And I can't wait to see how they do it. So,
dude, tell the story about Saturday when I texted you.
Oh, yeah. This is the strangest coincidence ever, and this keeps happening to me. So Lauren and I were, we got a new TV recently because our old TV had some pixel issues. So we were testing like some 4Ks out to see how it looked on the TV. And one of the 4Ks I popped in was Batman vs Superman Ultimate Edition. And about, I don't know, like 30-40 minutes into it, I'm at scenes where I remember being in full IMAX. I saw it in LA and in 70mm IMAX, and I just remember like the opening with Batman, young Batman. That's all IMAX. Like the entire Batman versus Superman fight is all IMAX. The entire, I mean, it's insane. The nightmare scene is all IMAX. And so I was looking at my my Blu-ray, and I'm like, it's not expanding. And I was like, yeah, I remember this not expanding when it first came out. And I'm like, why did Snyder? And this is also under the Nolan umbrella, because Nolan puts his movies out on Blu-ray through Warner Brothers, and it all has the IMAX aspect ratio shifts. They're not on this. And I looked at Lauren, and I literally said out loud, why doesn't this movie have the IMAX ratio shifts on it? 30 minutes later, Sean texts me an image that Snyder's confirming that they're going to be reissuing the film with the IMAX ratio shifts. And it happened literally within the time frame of when I asked Lauren that question. It was the strangest like coincidence ever.
I heard you ask it.
A single tear rolled down Kevin's cheek.
I guess elitist or whatever the word would be. But like, I'm just so used to the way Nolan presents his Blu-rays that any film shot in that format, like Ghost Protocol is one that really upsets me. Like Ghost Protocol, which is Mission Impossible, Brad Bird, shot the Burj Khalifa scene on IMAX film, 65mm IMAX film. I saw that on an 8-story screen in New York City when he was on that outside that building. The Blu-ray does not shift, and I don't understand how that's not being done. Nolan gets it done. So First Man got it done with Damien Chazelle. So it sounds like Snyder's retconning that now, which it needs to be done, because the IMAX photography in BVS is stunning. Like the opening is stunning. Even the funeral, the Superman funeral scenes in IMAX, it's unbelievable. So
when you see tweets that show how much more picture is shown, it's really eye-opening. I mean, I understand why you argue for it all the time.
It is an astounding difference when you see the IMAX version. When I put on Voodoo today for Tenet, it didn't have the IMAX. It cut off like so much of the image, and I couldn't believe it. But that's the way the nature of streaming is. So.
That's why you guys needed a new TV, because you threw your remote through the screen.
Yeah. Like, crap out of here!
All right, Lord goes, God, Kevin, not again. God,
yeah, you want to get the full 1.78, man. That full ratio is the best.
The McCarthy backyard is just littered with broken television sets. Constantly tossing them out. This week in movies, have you guys, either of you, seen Paul W.S. Anderson's Monster Hunter?
No. But I always wondered if Paul W.S. Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson ever been in the same room, though. That's one thing. Those are questions that I think about all the time, and I wonder if they've ever exchanged. Like, do you think Paul W.S. Anderson's like, hey, Paul T. Anderson, did you see Resident Evil 7? And he's like, no, did you see Phantom Thread?
And he says, no.
Here's a question. Has anyone ever seen the two of them together? How do we know they're not the same person?
Where does Wes Anderson fit in all of this?
Oh, there's so many Andersons.
That's what the WS stands for, I thought.
Absolutely. He's like, when I don't want to be so twee about everything, I had the period.
And make like Monster Hunter. Paul W.S. Anderson has to understand that he's, I wouldn't want to say lesser of the Paul Andersons.
No, you can say lesser. You can say lesser.
I will say Paul W.S. Anderson directed Event Horizon, and that movie's freaking awesome.
He's made some good stuff.
And I'd say that jokingly, but after the 10th Resident Evil, I just was like, dude, I mean, come on. Let's just
I give him credit, though. Those are uniquely his movies.
Yeah. I mean, dude.
And they employ both him and his wife.
True,
yeah.
There's a kill in the first one that's
He's married to Mila, right? Yeah. Isn't he married to Mila Jovovich?
Yeah. I believe so, yeah.
There's still... I will say, though, when you think about cinematic imagery, one of the images that comes to mind is from the first Resident Evil, when that guy
lasers.
Gets just the cut into cubes of, like, cheese slices.
I like the first one, because I love those video games. I like the Resident Evil games.
And I mean, Event Horizon... Yeah,
yeah. No, Kev, we're running a story on Cinema Blend this afternoon. Mike Reyes is because Mike Reyes interviewed.
I love Mike Reyes.
Paul and Mila for this movie for Monster Hunter, but he asked him about his director's cut of Event Horizon, and Paul W.S. Anderson told him that the Snyder Cut story has inspired him to want to go back and restore the longer version of Event Horizon because he said, "Get this.
Oh, that's cool.
There's a salt mine in." Like Transylvania, like the actual Transylvania, where he put prints of the movie to maintain them. It's almost like when we were talking to Tony Cerrone, Cervoni, and talked about that salt mine that's in the middle of was it Missouri or Kansas?
Yeah.
So that exists in Europe as well too, and that's where the Event Horizon reels are. And Paul W.S. Anderson wants to unearth them and put them back into Event Horizon.
Dude, Event Horizon, I will never forget seeing that with my parents. And there's that image that still haunts me of that guy on the ceiling. And his body is just completely open. Yeah. And he's just hanging there. Yeah. And then all I can see is Sam Neill and his wife, like haunting. Like, that movie is so terrifying. It's like one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. I've never revisited it. I've actually been too afraid to. It's just so brutal. But great movie, though.
Have either of you seen Fatale?
Yeah. I'm watching it tomorrow night, actually. I had,
Who's in it?
Michael Ealy and Hilary Swank, and then Mike Coulter from Luke Cage.
Oh, yeah. Has Hilary Swank been in like 8 movies this year? Feels like she's always got a movie out.
She hasn't been away a lot.
She will be soon because that show got canceled.
Her agent is on the hunt for new projects.
For Oscar number 3?
Yes, exactly.
She's looking for that next million-dollar baby.
All right. Let's get to Mario.
Every time we make fun of her, she can give us the finger with 2 Oscars.
Yeah, and by the way, there's no making fun of it. We actually, Hilary Swank's amazing, and she was actually a great interview for Away. Away was actually a really good show.
I was going to do the Fatale Junket tomorrow, and they pushed it to Thursday, and I can't do it Thursday, so I'm bummed that I have to miss out.
I want to give you guys time to rave about Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I did not get a chance to finish it, so I'm not going to really chime in, because I think Michelle and I only made about 30 minutes through, and then we just haven't gone back to it. Not for any quality of film. We started it late on a Thursday night or something like that, and then after about 30 minutes we were just like, can we pause it, and then everything's got so busy we didn't get back to it. But it's Chadwick Boseman's final performance. He's starring opposite Viola Davis in a adaptation of what I did not realize is a stage play, but it's one of those things where you very very quickly understand that the dialogue is delivered very much like a stage play. It's set primarily in a music studio where Viola Davis's character is coming in to record. Chadwick Boseman's one of the session musicians who dreams of bigger things, from what I can tell. He has bigger aspirations of where he'd like to go with his music. The other guys in the session musicians are very much play it by the page. And so, Kev, I remember when you first saw it, you really raved about it, and particularly about Chadwick. So where are you at with it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an outstanding film. I mean, it's 95 minutes. It's very quick, but it's also extremely dense in a good way, if that makes sense. It's layered but short, if that makes sense. I think about this a lot, and I have no basis for knowing if I'm right or wrong about this, but I just think a lot about Chadwick Boseman and the choices that he made as an actor to leave certain films behind, right? Mm-hmm. Like to have a legacy that's going to teach and put an imprint on people when they watch it. And I just think about these projects, because again, we didn't know he was dealing with cancer, and mm-hmm. and then he passed away, and now we examine his work and you start wondering what choices were made. And I can't help but think that this performance, in his mind, just from my perspective, he was like, you know what, I'm going to give everything I have right here. And I think he's always given everything he has, but I would argue that there was something in his mind that he knew this was one of his last, or one of the, and you know, this is the last film he did. again, this is just speculation, just based on how I feel about him as an actor and the roles he did prior to his passing. I mean, think about it. Black Panther, To Five Bloods. I mean, everything he did had some massive importance to it, right? Mm-hmm. And I was watching the film, you know, immersed in it, and I wasn't thinking about this specifically until it ended. But after the film ended, I couldn't help but look at him and go, dude literally went 150% in this performance. It is, mm-hmm. It's astounding. Like it is, it's musical. It's emotional. His arc is so, I won't say the word. There's a word I want to use, but I won't use it because it'll spoil it. But his arc is just very, it's a gut punch. There's something very emotional and immersive about what his character goes through in this 90 minutes. And I just think everything about the performance, like to a point where he's so famous and he just passed away, so he's on your mind. You know who Chadwick Boseman is.
Sure.
But I didn't think it was him the whole time. Like, that's how good he is in that film. Like, he becomes this character, and his story, and I don't know if Jake would agree, I love everybody in the movie. Viola Davis is fantastic. Everybody's amazing. But his story is, to me, the heart of the film. And I don't know if Jake would agree, but there's something about that character's past that is weaved into his narrative that is then structured as part of the story. I argue that it's more his story than Ma Rainey's, even though it's called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, only because of the what happens with this character, and also the moments that he leaves behind on screen. They left me with chills. His entire arc left me with chills. So I think that everybody in this film is incredible, but his performance, I think, is one of the best I've ever seen. And I genuinely think that it has nothing to do with his passing. It's just purely a phenomenal performance. But it's hard not to think about the fact that he made that choice for that to be his last film. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at.
I actually, I love Chadwick Boseman in the film, but for me, Viola Davis is the MVP, because for me, she just completely disappears in that role. To the point where I know it wasn't that long ago that we did Viola Davis blend. If we were to redo it, I might choose this. Like, that's just how good she is in this. I'm now also kind of low-key excited for this, like, new series of films that's apparently unfurling, because this is a part of, like, August Wilson's, like, Decades series, where he wrote plays based on every, like the African-American experience in America in different decades. So this, is, I guess, is the second one. Fences being the first. So they're all going to be produced by Denzel Washington. And so right now I'd say they're not only two for two, but like two pretty big home runs in a row.
That's pretty amazing. I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah. And so I think Fences is the 40s, and I want to say, Kevin, this is the third. This is the 1930s in Chicago.
Oh, they take place in the 30s. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is the 30s. I think Fences is the 40s. Not sure which one they're going to do next. But Kevin's right. Short amount of time, but packs a lot in. A really, really, really interesting sort of microcosm of the exploitation of African-American artists by white people at that time. And also something that, like, even though it's taking place in 1930s Chicago, you really wouldn't have to change that much to the story or to the script to have it take place in 2020 Chicago. Like, you know, there's a lot of different elements. And I think those are always the most interesting stories that take place 100 years ago. But all you really got to do is swap out the cars, the technology, and a few key words, and you can tell the exact same story in a completely different time period.
Right.
And I think it's really well done. I'm always hit and miss on play adaptations to the screen. Sometimes it just makes me think, well, I would just rather see this, like, on the stage. Sure. And then sometimes you look at something like Doubt, or something like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and you almost feel like you're watching, like it's so real and visceral that you almost feel like you can reach out and touch the people on the screen. This is low-key one of my favorite movies so far this year. I always feel weird saying favorite movie so far this year, this time of year, because then if you don't put it on your top 10 list, people are like, wait a second.
Yeah.
You didn't put it on, like, as if you can't have, like just a reminder for people, it is possible to love more than 10 movies in a year. But I'm always hesitant whenever I say, like, oh, it's one of my favorite movies so far this year in December, because then people get pissy if you don't put it on your top 10.
Look for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Netflix. Is it hitting on the 18th? Is that when it's...
Yeah, Friday.
This Friday. Yeah, this and Friday. It's an incredible film. It really is. And I mean, and Viola Davis is fantastic as well. I just felt like it was Chadwick's film. I don't know, for me personally. But.
All right, let's get to the blend game. Gabe came up with a really cool concept where he's doing, or we're all doing, original release blend. And the idea behind this, because we ended up getting really great people participating with really clever ideas. Original release blend means if you could go back in time and live through the opening weekend and experience a film without any of the baggage or you know, any of the stuff that comes with seeing it later, just being able to go into the theater on opening weekend and see it, what film would you choose? I'm going to go first, and I'm going to say that I had to go with a filmmaker who makes blockbusters to entertain mainstream audiences, potentially, according to Real Blend, the greatest director of all time. I had to pick Spielberg, and for Spielberg in particular, I had to choose Jaws. Because I just think that Jaws, the way that it snuck up on the audience and surprised them with, they had no clue what to expect, with the amount of surprises and shocks that are in Jaws, with being able to connect with those characters for the very first time and not really knowing, like, I can't even think back to a moment in Jaws where I didn't know who would survive or not, but I can at least remember seeing it early on and being afraid for the safety of the three main guys by the time they finally went out to, because by that point, the movie had basically shown you that nobody was safe, that it was willing to get rid of a kid, that it was willing to take down a girl in the opening scene, that, you know, you always felt like if anybody was in the water, that they truly were in danger. And I still think that the use of the shark is so visceral and gets those scares out of it. But I can't imagine what it was like the opening weekend with an audience who was seeing that for the very first time. The, you know, why don't you come down here and chum some of this shit kind of thing with Bruce sticking his head up and just the terror that comes with that. Like that has to be the ultimate goose the audience moment. And I just think that the final 15, 20 minutes of Jaws, or, you know, you think of like Dreyfus getting in the cage and going into the water and just all of the, even the quote unquote cheap scares of, you know, the head that comes into the hole and scares Dreyfus. Like, you can almost telegraph that. You know that that's coming, but Jaws has so many authentic, I don't expect these things to really scare me kind of thing. And I would assume that opening weekend, and of course, you know, it's the birth of the modern blockbuster. Theaters ended up becoming packed. But I think it would be really fun to go back to that weekend, experience it, you know, even going into it to see what is Jaws, who is this Spielberg kid, you know, who's had a couple of films before, but hasn't really broken through. And just to see a movie grip an audience like that, that's what I chose.
I just picture, like, if film Twitter existed at that time, film Twitter would just be so obnoxious. You'd be like, oh, he's just doing Duel again. It's Duel with a shark.
I think I know both of your answers. And so I would like to guess. Can I guess?
Sure.
Jake, I think you chose Empire Strikes Back.
Very close.
Oh, all right, go ahead.
I chose the original Star Wars.
Okay, fair enough.
Not A New Hope, not Episode 4.
Yeah.
Just a film called Star Wars.
Okay.
I've never lived a life, basically, without knowing what Star Wars was. Even before my dad introduced it to me, I was still aware of what it was like in the realm of pop culture. Like, I knew what Yoda was. I knew what Luke Skywalker, I knew Darth Vader was. I can't imagine having no preconceived notion of what that story is. And you're sitting in a theater and you've heard a couple of things about it, and you see in silence a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and then John Williams' music, Star Wars, flies back. You got the scroll, but from the scroll you got the spaceship coming overhead. That is just that opening scene alone.
Yeah,
I can't imagine. And for me, the thing is, I actually almost chose Jaws, but I think the reason I went with Star Wars is just because of its significance to me personally. But as significant as it is, I'll never get to have that moment. I'll never get to experience it like that. One of my favorite Lucas quotes is one of his few regrets for creating Star Wars is that he never got to watch Star Wars. He never got to sit in a theater and be wowed by the Rebel ship coming overhead and then the Imperial, you know, Star Destroyer coming overhead. And so, yeah, I understand what he means. Like I've seen that scene. I've from start to finish, I watched it the other day. From start to finish, I've probably seen it triple digits. And I always think sometimes people are exaggerating when they talk about how many times, not Kevin, but I think most people are exaggerating about how many times I've seen a movie. Yeah. I've probably seen it probably a little bit over 100 times, but I've never seen it like that. Right. And I really wish I could. I wish I could see it blindly.
Kevin, I think you chose Psycho.
That is correct.
Yeah, I got one.
Yeah, that is 100%
correct. Okay, you were pretty close on mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got both of them. I would say you got both of them.
Yeah.
For me, I don't get angry about a lot of things, but one thing that genuinely grinds my gears, as Peter Griffin says on Family Guy, are people showing up to a theater 15, 20 minutes into a movie. So much so that I get personally offended by that. Like if I'm sitting in a movie theater and someone walks in 20 minutes into the movie, it actually ruins my experience because then I feel bad that they had just missed all that setup. I've seen people walk in, and I saw people walk in 20 minutes into Tenet when I saw Tenet. Like, how could you miss that opening scene in the opera?
Livid. Like, Kevin just started screaming at them.
I had to hold myself back from saying, can you please get out of here and come back to the next showing? What are you
doing? Okay, but wait, hold on. Let me go, because every once in a while now, if I'm coming out of a movie theater and a screen is playing something that I love, especially like when Endgame was playing or Infinity War,
it's different.
I jumped in and would just watch it from wherever I was. So I could have angered you. What if that person
had
seen it?
It's almost as frustrating as someone walking in the end of Star Wars Episode 9 and just completely ruining that film for them.
Right. But it's a great story. So the reason why I chose Psycho is, and this is a really famous story, and I actually found the poster for it, which makes me really excited.
Oh, cool.
So when Hitchcock put out Psycho, he had a mandate. Like, it's kind of like, it's cool. Like, Hitchcock used to really control a lot of the promotion of his movies and kind of how that happened. So with Psycho,
he had so much power.
Right. He had a mandate, and I'm going to read the poster. This is an actual poster. It says, it is required that you see Psycho from the very beginning. The next showing of Psycho begins at, and then it would have a block of what time the showing was. The manager of this theater has been instructed at the risk of his life not to admit to the theater any persons after the picture starts. Any spurious attempts to enter by side doors, fire escapes, or ventilating shafts will be met by force. The entire objective of this extraordinary policy, of course, is to help you enjoy Psycho more. Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, that to me is such
worth pointing out. For people who maybe have listened to Alfred Hitchcock words for the first time, he's a very tongue-in-cheek, funny guy, and that is a perfect tone of how he would set the scene.
Right, and that's a poster I was looking at just online. So, but the reason why I picked that is because I would love to have been in those lines outside, not knowing what I was about to experience. And you have to understand, like, if you take yourself out of knowing what Psycho is and you see that Janet Leigh scene for the first time without any setup,
the person who you think is the star of the entire film,
right, killed off in the first 25 minutes. And it is a very brutal scene. It's incredibly well edited, but to have been in that theater of people expecting that character to continue on for the 2 hours or whatever the time frame of the film would be, for that death to happen that quickly, and then for everybody in that theater to collectively go, what are we about to experience?
Yeah.
And I think with Psycho, you know, I think I much like classic twists like Usual Suspects or whatever, a lot of those things were ruined for me before I saw them. You know, obviously, you know, Luke's father being Vader and like all that stuff, all those things were ruined for me. They were part of culture. Like Janet Leigh's death in Psycho is pop culture now. It is, it's iconic, so much so that Jamie Lee Curtis recreated it herself for Instagram for like an anniversary. So for me, I always found that it was cool that even at that point in film history, there was a filmmaker who was so in tune with this idea that you have to be there from the start and you can't just walk in. Could you imagine walking into Psycho 25 minutes in and it missed that scene?
Where the hell is Janet Leigh?
Right. And so, like, you know, so to me, it was cool that a filmmaker had that power. in order to try that. But also, what I love about that story is that it showed you how passionate Hitchcock was about the theatrical experience and you having the best experience possible. And for me, it just really grinds my gears. Like I said, like when someone walks into a theater 20 minutes in, I want to go over to them and say, please don't, you're ruining this for yourself. You're also making me angry, but you're ruining this for yourself. So that's the experience I would love to have had. I would love to have been in one of those sold out lines outside with a random stranger. And like, you know, we're getting ready to see the new Hitchcock film. We have no idea what's about to happen. There's no Twitter spoilers. There's no Facebook spoilers. It hasn't been ruined. News of the World was, there's a movie coming out called News of the World. And we have Greengrass on the show this week. And there's an interesting element in the story that, you know, as Tom Hanks goes around and reads the news to people who don't know the news of the world, people who work all day long and don't have that ability. And I sat there and looked at myself. I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, could you imagine not knowing every minute what is happening in the world? I think we would live better lives. Be honest with you, I think we're so connected that it's...
I get on Facebook and most people on Facebook don't know what's going on in the world.
Right. But the news cycle is so fast now that we don't even emotionally connect to anything anymore. It's just like, right. It's just boom, 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 boom. And so it was just an interesting revelation of like the times. And I kind of like, I would imagine that the Psycho times, just like the Jaws times or the Star Wars times that you guys brought up, mm-hmm. were special things that weren't ruined, that were collective communal experiences that you got to have with total strangers. And you're all universally feeling the same thing, essentially.
We can still chase those at film festivals. A lot of times you find something at a film festival that people haven't seen yet. But even the ones that come with advanced buzz have a little bit of it taken away from them. One recent one for me was at South By when we saw Cabin in the Woods. And nobody knew what Cabin in the Woods was yet. Yeah. We just knew it was Joss Whedon. Nobody knew Drew Goddard yet at that point.
Yeah.
And I can remember being in the Paramount Theater, the main venue in Austin for Cabin in the Woods, and it just played the audience like a fiddle, and it was amazing.
Yeah. I remember, like, and again, not to, I know we have to wrap up, but like films like we've had, and this might be another discussion we could have at some other point in the show, what films have had that cultural impact in our lifetime? So, like, you know, I would argue The Matrix or Jurassic Park, films that were so monumentally game-changing that if you got to experience The Matrix in a theater for the first time without knowing what it was, it was, I'll never forget, I walked into the
kind
wrong...
Kind of what this discussion is.
Yeah. It's, what? Yeah. Yeah, kind of. But it's no,
kind
but,
of
but, no, I'm on the opposite end. I'm like the ones that we did get to have.
That you got to see.
And so, like, for me, I'll never forget, and again, much like the Hitchcock story I told, I'll never forget going to an AMC, I think I've told this before, to see Matrix with my dad and my uncle. And I walked into Theater 12... by mistake instead of Theater 11. And when I walked in, it was the helicopter sequence where the helicopter's going down. And this usher came and grabbed me. Not that he was mad that I walked in the theater. He's like, dude, you're going to ruin the movie for yourself. You walked into the wrong theater. Because he actually cared.
That's awesome. Great. I love
about
that.
About my like ruining of the moment. And like, I just don't know if we have that today. Like, it's just so different. Film
may get back to that now,
different.
Though. The way the movies are going to have to go back to theaters, you may get back to them being an event. You know, I hope they end up becoming an event.
Like by the way, Dark Knight just got inducted into the Library of Congress this week. I wanted to give a shout out to that. That's huge crazy. Deal.
And Shrek. Yeah. Did Shrek get in?
Yeah.
The first one?
Yeah,
Shrek,
I think so.
Shrek, Blues Brothers, Grease.
Brendan is so obsessed with Shrek. More as like a meme. That every time we leave our laptops open around the house, he opens up a window and puts like some type of Shrek meme. And it's annoying, but I again admire his consistency.
Admire that consistency, that conviction.
I'm away from my computer and I come back to it. I'm waiting. I have Shrek waiting for me on my computer. All right, audience picks. Jake Skelly chose Jurassic Park. Really good choice. Karen Schumacher. Damian McDonnell and many others went with Jaws. Indy Christina said The Godfather. Leonard Wilson said Seven. Ryan Jones and many others showing love for 2001 A Space Odyssey. Yes, another really good one, I would imagine.
Yeah, that
would
have been
great
cool.
opening weekend. For next week, based off of where we are going with Wonder Woman, this is going to be very, very challenging. Please play along with hashtag Chris Pine, actually for 2 weeks, we're going to play hashtag Chris Pine Blend. So let us know your pick via email at realblend@cinemablend.com. You can play along on social media using hashtag Chris Pine Blend. And when you are sending us your pick, you can also leave us a review, because we do not have one for this week. So go to
Why Don't You Love Us
Podcasts. It helps us grow the show. And we also will review your review on air. Gabe, can you please update the audience on the Hollywood schedule? The holiday schedule for our Hollywood updates. Gabe, what are we going to be doing for the next couple weeks?
Yes, so for those of you that were here for the Thanksgiving week, we're having a similar schedule for Christmas, which is next week. Next week.
Yeah.
Goodness.
We are taking next week off. For premium subscribers, you will still get a premium episode that week and the next. But we will be back the last week of the year answering the Chris Pine question, Chris Pine Blend, and giving our top fives of 2020.
Five?
Yeah. We always do five? Top five. Top 10. That's 30 movies. We got to about 30 different movies. That's a lot.
We spent 18 minutes on cheeseburgers.
Assume they're going to come up again in a couple weeks.
That's kind of normal. You know what? I like that we're doing five. I think that's a little bit stronger.
I could be wrong, but I think we've done five for the last 3 years.
That's a good question.
I think haven't we always done like rapid fire 10 through 6 and then discussed
five? Can we do that? Can we list our 10 through 6?
We'll talk about it.
Before we pop into five, I'd like to do we'll that talk if we could. Yeah.
That's fine.
I started to put together a list this week and I only have about 7 movies.
I have my list. My list is pretty hasn't changed except for one movie that I need.
Well,
to...
tune in in a couple weeks.
I think I'm gonna take a big swing with my number one.
I'm curious what it's gonna be. Hold on, never mind. I'll think about it next week. All right. So anyway, you can follow us online at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell. Follow the show at Real Blend. And until next week, Hubie. Oh, Hubie! This is gonna be our number one movie of the year, Hubie Halloween.
We have to stop. We have to stop.
No, we don't.
When we get the director of Hubie Halloween on the show.
I'm busy that day.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed, when I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.